I thought the news actually spent 3 quick minutes talking about a program you might or might not have heard of yesterday that we just launched. But I thought I'd just raise awareness here. If you're interested, it's a program called Website Spark. How many people have heard of Website Spark? Okay, pretty much everyone. But anyway, quickly for the few people that haven't, Spark programs at Microsoft are programs designed to allow you to quickly get started without having to pay any upfront costs in terms of license fees for software. We have BizSpark today available for startups. You get 3 years of software for your startup. DreamSpark is something we offer for students. And then yesterday, we just launched Website Spark for web developers and web professionals. And basically, if you build websites on behalf of others, so either as an independent developer or as a company with less than 10 employees that build sites for other companies, you can enroll in the program. You get 3 years of 3 copies of Visual Studio Professional at no cost. You get a 4-processor edition of Windows Web Server, as well as Windows SQL Server Web Edition that you can run either on 4 servers or 1 4-proc server. You get a copy of Expression Studio that includes Blend and Sketchflow for Silverlight. You also get a copy of 2 copies of Expression Web, and you get a premium web control panel, which allows you to kind of remotely manage your site. You get all of that at no cost for 3 years. You get training support as well as training modules for all that software. And then basically there's an opportunity to tie into our partner network so we can generate sales leads for you. At the end of the 3 years, there's no obligation, so you don't have to continue using the software if you don't want. There is an optional ability to buy a package that has everything in that. So 4 copies of SQL, 4 copies of Windows Server, 3 copies of Visual Studio, copy of Expression, copy of 2 copies of Expression Web. The exit offer in dollars, we have 3 years before anyone can buy it. Is basically $999 a year, so probably less than that in euros. Or you can buy servers at $199 for both a Windows and SQL license per year as a deployment package if you want to. Again, there's no obligation at the end of the 3 years if you don't want to. So it's an opportunity there that you can take advantage of. To get started, you can go to Microsoft.com/web. Or you can go to websitespark.com. And basically, the way it works is you enter your live ID or register for a live ID. You can either indicate a hoster or enter an enrollment code that gets you in the program. If you send me email, I'll give you an enrollment code, in which case, this weekend, you can be downloading and deploying all of that software I just mentioned. So again, if you want an enrollment code, feel free to send me email, scottq@microsoft.com, and I'd be happy to send you one. And away you go. So anyway, that's a new program you can take advantage of. Tell your friends. A great way to get started with ASP.NET, Visual Studio, .NET, Windows, SQL, etc. Question that a lot of people ask, especially since we just did the VS10 talk, is, hey, if I enroll the program now, will I get Visual Studio 2010 when it comes out? The answer is yes. Basically, when you're in this program, we give you an access to the MSDN subscription site. As well as the products that I listed that are in there. And so any updates to those products over the 3-year time period, you can download. And so when Visual Studio 2010 comes out, you can automatically download it and start using it. Again, no cost for 3 years. There is a $100 cost at the end of the 3 years to exit the program, but there's no cost for the 3 years. Anyway, yeah, if you're interested in learning more, you can go to my blog, and I have a lot more details about it. And again, send me an email if you'd like an enrollment code, and I'd be happy to send you one. So the second talk I'm going to do is on ASP.NET MVC, which stands for Model View Controller. How many people have used ASP.NET MVC? Okay, a lot of people have. A lot of people haven't. So what I'm going to talk about in this talk is provide kind of a end-to-end experience with ASP.NET MVC, and basically build a ASP.NET MVC app from scratch, kind of explaining all the different concepts. I'm going to be using the new release of ASP.NET MVC, which is ASP.NET MVC 2, and showing off some features that also haven't been shown publicly before today that you can take advantage of with that new release. So even if you do know ASP.NET MVC, hopefully there'll be a number of things along the way that you'll like and see for the first time here. So a couple things that are important. So what is ASP.NET MVC? Basically, ASP.NET MVC is another option for doing web UI with ASP.NET. We've had since the beginning our web forms model, which uses a control-based model for generating UI. MVC uses a different approach. It emphasizes kind of a strict separation between components within the application. It does not have a control model. Instead, it sort of is a lower-level template-based approach to generating HTML. And it's basically just a separate option that builds on top of ASP.NET. A key thing we always like to emphasize is the core of ASP.NET is the same. So things like security, caching, configuration, process model, all of those things are identical between them. The only difference is kind of how you build UI and how you structure your app. But all the goodness at the lower ends of ASP.NET are the same. And then what we're doing, you'll see in this talk, is both with Ajax and with dynamic data, you can basically use both web forms and MVC in order to do things like scaffolding, to use things like Ajax, and do things like model validation, which I showed a little bit in the previous talk on VS10. I'll show more in this talk using MVC instead. So a lot of commonality, and basically you can choose. A lot of the reasons why people like MVC, typically people either love or hate MVC, and both are completely fine reactions. MVC does not replace web forms. Web forms is not going away. As you saw in the previous talk, there's lots of work, lots of improvement that we've done with web forms with the most recent .NET 4 release. But MVC does provide an alternative way to do web UI that some people like, some people hate. If you like it, great. If you hate it, great. You can use web forms. We're not trying to favor one over the other. Both are perfectly valid. The reason some people like MVC is it does give you kind of complete control over your HTML. And so if you're someone who likes to be deep in the HTML and have that kind of complete control, MVC is nice. It gives you intuitive website URLs as part of the core programming model. This used to be a big differentiation with ASP.NET Web Forms. As you saw in that previous talk, Web Forms now also has SEO URLs as well. And they use the same routing engine. But MVC has very nice support for this, and you'll see some nice demos of this in a little bit. It's great for integrating with client-side JavaScript and Ajax. And then the other big thing is it supports testability and the concept of test-driven development, kind of native to the programming model. But again, it's not for everyone. I often use the analogy of manual versus automatic transitions in cars. One is not better than the other. One feels natural to some people. One feels more familiar to others. Whichever you prefer is the version you can use with ASP.NET, and you can take advantage of the broad benefits of ASP.NET at the core with both. So we shipped ASP.NET MVC 1 earlier this year, and you can use it with .NET 3.5 and .NET 3.5 SP1 today. ASP.NET MVC 2 is currently in preview form. We shipped a preview 1 release in July, and we're going to be shipping a preview 2 release in the next couple days, for next week and a half. Sometime soon, in case we have to slip a day, I don't want to jinx myself, but sometime very soon. yeah, whatever, you know. Anyway, the MVC, ASP.NET MVC 2 will work. The final release will ship for both within Visual Studio 2010 to be included, but it will also ship as a separate download that works on top of .NET 3.5 and works with VS 2008 today. So if you're in a company that says, hey, we might wait a year to upgrade to VS, hopefully after my talk earlier, you convinced your company to upgrade faster. But if you are going to take a little while to upgrade, the good news is you can still use MVC 2 with your existing Visual Studio and .NET 3.5 releases. And there's lots of new features in MVC 2, much better validation support, much better support for what we call templated HTML helpers, Much better support for something we call areas, which allow you to kind of group your site into logical pieces. A whole bunch of new helpers, and lots of other things that I didn't mention up here that'll show up in later previews as well. So lots of improvements there. But enough talking. Let's actually go ahead and write some code. By the way, you can download this from www.asp.net/mvc. If you use the web platform installer, it's also something you can directly install through that. So, it's my minimalistic slides. Let's actually write some code and build an app. So, when you install, I'm going to use Visual Studio 2008, so give you the experience you'd have if you use it with Visual Studio 2008. When you install the project template and you say File New Project, you'll notice there's a new ASP.NET MVC or ASP.NET MVC 2 web application template that you can use. What do you want to call this application? Hello, Scott. Okay. Hello, Scott app. You'll notice when you first create the project, it asks you, do you want to also unit test, really create a unit test project for this application at the same time? You can either say yes and name the project whatever you want. You can use any type of unit test framework that you want with it. We have hooks for InUnit, MVUnit, XUnit. When you have those installed, it'll just be available in the dropdown for to pick from, or you can say, no, don't create a unit test project as well. But I'm going to basically click Create an MS Test One. This will basically go ahead and create here both my MVC application and then also a unit test project for testing that application directly within the product. How many people use unit testing? How many people know that they should use unit testing but don't? It's okay. A cool thing is when you create this project, you can actually say run all tests in the solution, and you'll notice that it comes pre-built with 20 unit tests. And so just by creating the project, you can say, you too use unit testing. probably add your own test to that list too, but it's a start. So what does this project create? So this project creates a couple things. Let's actually just run it and see what the app looks like. And by the way, we will add unit tests later on in this talk. So we will be talking about that shortly. But this basically is creating a simple MVC application. It has a home and about tab. It has a login screen and a registration screen. So if you remember in my previous ASP.NET talk earlier, I showed an equivalent app with web forms. We have the same with MVC today. Basically just provides a simple way to get started, and you're not staring at a blank form at the very beginning when you build your app. Everything is CSS enabled. Everything uses a master page. Makes it really easy to customize and tweak. You'll notice that the URL structures, there's clean URLs. So for example, I have a home URL. I can have an about URL. If I click on the login link, I have a login slash logon URL. If I click the register, it's account slash register. So very logical SEO-friendly URLs. That's sort of a core feature of ASP.NET MVC that you get for free. In terms of how this project is implemented, let's look at the folder structure. So we basically have in our Hello Scott app a couple of different folders that are created for you by default. You'll notice there's a folder called Controllers, which we'll talk about in a little bit. That's the C in Model View Controller, or MVC. And you notice there's an account and a home controller. And if you remember back, we had the home URLs and we had the slash account URLs. Those URLs map to these classes. There's a models folder, which is where we're going to store our data code, as well as the objects that represent kind of the data structures of our application. There's a scripts folder that includes by default jQuery, as well as the Microsoft Ajax client scripts. There's a content folder, which has a CSS file and any static images you want to put. And then there's a views folder, which is where we're going to put our template files for generating our HTML UI. You're not required to use this directory structure, but it's one that we strongly encourage, and we're kind of trying to provide kind of a convention over configuration based approach, which means that every MVC app, when you open it, looks familiar, and you can immediately be productive within it. We'll see some examples of how we take advantage of that. So let's say I want to build some functionality to handle some URLs. Oh, actually, let's talk about that first, and we'll do it. So one of the biggest changes from a traditional web model with either, say, web forms with ASP.NET or something like classic ASP or PHP, where typically when a URL comes in, it maps to a file on disk, like a default.aspx or a home.aspx file, is that in a model view controller-based environment, URLs typically map instead to methods that are on controller classes or classes called controllers. And so instead of going directly to a template file, you instead go to a method on a class. That method runs, and then that method might optionally use a file on disk in order to render the HTML back. And that's kind of the biggest conceptual difference as you think about an MVC-based approach. So if I want to build one of these classes that will handle URLs, I can right-click on the controllers folder and say new add controller. When I do that, it'll ask me for a file name that I want to create. Any particular?
Say hello.
Let's not have me say hello just because there's many say hellos in this app. It might be confusing. Well, I'm going to create a products controller later. I'm going to create a simple controller for now, and then we'll add a say hello method to it. Because I'm going to add a products controller a little bit later. So anyway, I just created this new class called Simple Controller. It's got a method in here called index. I'm going to change this for just a second and actually just say return say hello. Or actually just say hello world, how about, to begin with, and then we'll add a say hello method later. So anyway, I have a simple method here called index. It's on a simple controller. By default, ASP.NET MVC will map URLs that are coming in. The first portion of the URL, it'll map to the class. So if I have a slash simple URL, it'll map to the simple controller by default. Again, that's just the convention approach we use. And then it'll look for a method on that controller to use. And by default, if you have index method, we'll use that as the default method to call on the class. When that URL comes in. So right now, if I have public string simple and I go back, by slash simple, it'll say hello world. As you can see here, I can return a string of content if I want to. If I wanted to create now, let's say, the say hello method, so I want to map simple dot slash say hello, I could create a new method called say hello. And now when a URL comes in, slash simple, it'll activate the simple class. If there's no following slash, by default it'll call index. Otherwise it'll call the say hello method if it's slash simple say hello. And so now it refresh, still says hello world, simple slash say hello. Now it says say hello. Make sense? Now let's say we want to have a parameter. So I want to say hello, question, name equals Scott. And I want to basically output the name values passed in. I can optionally say string name. And so instead of saying say hello, I could say, and I'm going to HTML, oops, I'm going to HTML encode this so I can't do a scripting attack. But you'll notice all I need to do in order to map query string parameters or form post parameters is just create a variable parameter on that method, name the same thing. And now if I say this, it'll just say, it'll say hello. And if I say hello, name equals Scott, it'll say hello. It's hello Scott. It's late. So basically a very simple way that you can pass parameters and map them into methods. Yeah?
Can you also do say hello slash Scott that will value method and name?
Yeah, so good question. So the question is, could we do something like say hello slash Scott and map it to the name? The answer is yes. We'll actually give me a few minutes because I'm going to get to that in a little bit. But basically, one of the things you can do is flexible routing rules. And so we're going to do that for a products controller in a little bit. So the answer is yes, but I'm going to hold off just so I don't lose people until that point. You can also do what's called nullable parameters. So let's say I want to say, okay, we'll do it. So if I wanted to, I could actually add another parameter, which is, say, int num. And I could say, hello, Scott. Anyway, you can map hello num. You can also map what are called nullable types. And so just do a question mark and that makes it nullable, in which case this will either be the value or it'll be a default value or be a nullable type if no value is specified. Make sense? So those are all options. We're going to look at much more depth about this in a little bit. So right now, you see, we can create controller classes, we can map URLs to them, we can map parameters in. Right now, our controller actions are returning HTML as strings, which you can certainly do. But the challenge is going to be, as you build more complex UI, that doesn't scale very well. And both from a maintenance perspective and then also from an architecture perspective. And so one of the things that MVC kind of really strives for is this thing called separation of concerns. The idea being that you separate out your application logic from your data model logic from your UI generation logic. And that can logically map to your application logic being your controllers, your data validation and things like that being your model, and then views being what you actually use to generate HTML template UI back. Typically, the way this works is that a URL comes in, activates a controller class, calls a method on that controller class, passes in parameters. Controllers go off and get data. They can then take specified amount of data that we're going to call view model data and pass it off to a template to say, go render a response back. And by doing that, you basically separated out the rendering phase from the actual controller application logic phase and introduced kind of a separation of concerns between the two. So again, the controller gets the data, passes it off to a template. The template is what actually renders the response back. So let's switch this simple say hello to do that. So in the say hello string, let's say rather than return back a string, I could instead use something called a view data object and basically say I want to have a message. And I'm going to have the message just be hello. And I'm going to lose the H1 because that's sort of UI formatting logic. And I'm instead just going to have the message be something like that. So this view data collection that's available on controllers, you can think of it as effectively a dictionary of data that you want to pass off to a template. To use a template to render, I'm going to do two things. One is I'm going to change the return result from this method from being a string to being an action result class. This is basically indicating the type of result I want to send back from this controller action method. And what I want to do is I'm going to say return back a view, which we'll talk about in a second. And I can say I'm going to render a template called say hello. And this is going to cause us to look for a template file called say hello on disk, take the view data, pass it to it. It'll then generate a response back to the client. So to implement this file on disk, we're going to put it inside the views folder of our application. By default, in a convention approach, we have a separate folder for every controller in our project. So you notice we have an account controller, we have an account view. We have a home controller, we have a home view directory. And then we basically put the template files that we use for rendering inside there. And by default, we have the template files typically mapped to the action method names inside our controller. So you can manually create this. With MVC, you can also just do right-click and do add view. By default, Visual Studio will figure out what action method you're in. So in this case, it knows I'm in the say hello action method. I can then say I want to create a file. I can choose to base it on a master template, which is using the same master template syntax that we use for web forms. Click add. And Visual Studio will, by default, create now a simple directory for us because we're in the simple controller and add a say hello template because we're in the say hello action method. And I could then say, this is my template. Or I could actually say, what would you, H1 here, H1. Remember, in our controller, we're populating a view data message property. So what I could do inside here is access it from within my template and say, view data message, like that. And now here, hit refresh. Instead of just returning a string, I'm now, my action method is taking Scott as a parameter. It's saying return a view. It's loading up that template file, which is based on the master template that my site has. And my template file is basically outputting the message in the location I wanted it to and sending it back as HTML. Make sense? So that's conceptually the biggest sort of difference in terms of how you do UI. You map URLs to controllers. You stick whatever data you want inside the view data or populate it, and then you basically call a template to render. Because we use this convention-based approach for finding directory structures, we can actually simplify this code even more so that instead of saying view say hello, which is the template name, as long as the template name matches the action name, you can actually get rid of this and just say return view with no parameters, and everything will continue to work. So by default, it'll just let it take advantage of the action name in order to do it. Say David, it'll return back now, hello David. A couple of questions people often ask, especially if they're coming from a strongly typed background in VB or C#, is this whole dictionary thing feels a little messy. Do I have to pass in the strings? You know, is there any way to get IntelliSense? How do I avoid errors? So with MVC, we basically support two approaches for that. One is pass in a dictionary like I'm doing here. The other one is to take advantage of classes we call view model classes and do it in a strongly typed way. So what does that mean? So I could say, for example, a public class, say hello view model. So I'm going to create my own custom class. I'm going to say public string message as a strongly typed property. I could say public int num times. Number of times I want to actually display the message I don't know how I managed to type that, but I could have a numTimes property, and I could basically then replace this code here, where I could instead say var view model equals new say hello view model. And with .NET 3.5, there's this syntax for doing kind of implicit initialization of things. And so I can say message equals, and basically copy that to be like so. And I can say numTimes equals 1 for right now. And then if I wanted to pass this view model to my template, I would just say new view, return view, and then pass in view model as a parameter. And so this is going to basically pass a strongly typed object to my template, and then it can then use it instead of the dictionary to render the response back. I'm going to keep track of my namespace here. To get strongly typed IntelliSense within this view template, all I need to do is change the inherits attribute up here to basically be say hello view model as the type I'm going to be passing into the template. So this just tells ASP.NET MVC, hey, instead of passing in this late-bound dictionary, instead allow the user to type model dot, type model dot, and you'll see it now gives me IntelliSense for that say hello view model, and so I can do it like so. Hit refresh, and now this is displaying the message. If I want to display it multiple times, I could say for in I equals 0, I less than model dot num times, I plus plus. You remember right now we're hard coding in 1 as the value, so I hit refresh, it's still going to show 1. I could alternatively here say, let's have a second parameter, which is int num times, and basically say num times here as passing it as a parameter. I could, as I mentioned earlier, make this nullable, and so I could say num times dot get value or default. Which will say the default is 1 if it's not specified. And now when I run this, It'll still only display zero or one time by default, but if I say and num times equals 55, I get 55 outputs. Make sense? So basically think of it as a way your controllers can handle the URLs, grab the data, populate a data object, pass it to the template, it renders the response back. And that's sort of the separation of concerns. You'll see as it gets richer, kind of some of the benefits you get from this. It makes it easier to test. It makes it easier to structure your code.
Yep.
Does it use a reflection to populate data from the struct type class, or is it actually compiled into the...
It's actually compiled into the view template. So it actually is not using reflection right there to retrieve it. Instead, we use generics in C# and VB to basically create a generic model property. And that's how you get the strong type intel sense. There's also an optional feature you can do, which is to compile your view pages, and so you'll get syntax checking as well as at compilation or build time, so you can look for any errors in the code there. So we talked about controllers, we talked about views, let's now talk a little bit more about the model. So in the MVC world, model refers to basically the objects that represent the data of the application and the corresponding validation and domain logic. So we'll talk about the validation and domain logic in a little bit. But basically, you can think of it as the objects that come out of your database. So if you're using linked to SQL, it might be the product and category object, or it could be your own objects that you create that you put between your database and your actual application that surface your application data in an alternative form from the actual persistence format. So you can use any data form, you know, any data API you want with MVC. For the sake of this app, we're going to import our favorite Northwind database. At some point, I'm hoping someone will give me a new database to use, but Northwind until then. And then let's just go ahead and create a link to SQL set of classes that map to the Northwind. And so... I could open up the database and basically take categories and products, keep things simple, drag it onto the designer. This is going to basically model a category and product class that maps to my categories and products table. So this is just standard link to SQL. Let's then build something richer than the simple controller. Let's build a products controller that we use to basically display product information for our site. So to do that, I'll create a new controller. I'm going to call it products controller. Let's have the default URL. So when you do slash products, basically display a listing of product data. So I'm going to add a field member called Northwind. To my controller that we'll be using. For the product's data, let's grab back a list of categories. So we'll do a category listing when you use slash products. And so I'm just going to say northwind.products.to list. And I'm then going to basically say, let's display category listing there. We'll add a view. We're going to make it strongly typed, so rather than go into the template and have to change it, you'll notice I can actually choose to say base it on category, and I can create this is what's called scaffolding, so I'm going to say create a list of products or categories. We're going to come back to scaffolding a little bit, so pretend you didn't see that. And instead, let's just, in the interest of time, I'm just going to rather type it. I'm just going to basically add some code here. Which basically is just going to output a ULLI element. It's just looping over each category object inside the file. We'll actually show this. And so I can say category dot category name. You'll notice here I'm using the inferred syntax of C#. So model is strongly typed, so var category is going to be of type category, which means I do get IntelliSense. And now, I do slash products. I now get a listing of my category details back. Make sense? Now, and actually, just to snazz it up a little bit, we'll go into our CSS file and add a little CSS snippet. Ooh, there we go. We'll do more with CSS later. That was a very subtle change. If you were a designer, you'd appreciate my art. But so anyway, so right now I'm just generating a ULLI list. A lot of people look at this code sometimes and say, ooh, this feels kind of like ugly. For some people it is. But basically, it just outputs standard HTML. And so for people that really care about what their HTML structure is, they often look at this ability to do the embedding of the code as actually a benefit as opposed to a detraction. If you're someone who says, I don't really care what the HTML is, you know, I want to focus on the application, you know, that server control abstraction we have in web forms gives you a nice way to abstract that. So a lot of that goes back to the automatic versus manual transmission analogy. Both are completely valid. It's whatever feels most comfortable to you. Now, what I want to do with this category listing is I want to link to a details page or a products page from each of these categories. So in other words, I click beverages as a link. I go to a separate page which browses all of the products within that category. We can do two things to do that. First step is we're going to create a new action method that's going to be called browse. So we want this URL to be products, browse, and then for right now we're going to have it be a query string, and so we'll say category beverages. So we'll have a parameter called beverages, or category. And rather than give back all the categories, we're going to say var products, and we'll say from p in northwind.products, where p.category.categoryName equals category. Select p. And then we're just going to pass this list of products off to a view template to render. Make sense? You can? We probably should. Don't do that. Good catch. It'll work otherwise as well, but this is actually a better approach to use. So we now have a products browse. Let's go ahead and implement that. So again, we're going to create it. Instead of basing it on category, we'll base it on the product class. We're also going to templatize it. We're also going to pretend we didn't see the scaffold and just get rid of that and move it on later. And then implement the products HTML. In terms of time, again, I'm just going to copy and paste this. This basically is just going to list over each of the items in the model. Now the items are products. I'm outputting the product name, and then I'm formatting the unit price as a string. Last thing I'll just do before I run this is add a product image graphic into my project. And now, in addition to products, I can say product slash browse, category equals beverages. And I now get beverages back. And if I say products equals condiments, I get condiments. So basically a simple way I can do product browsing. Now let's tie these two URLs together so that when I can actually click the beverage, I get the beverage, and I click condiments and get the condiments. A couple ways I could do that. I could go back to my index method, which is the category listing. I could write inside here an anchor tag manually and say like, hey, ahref equals and embed the URL parameter. HTML MVC also has this concept we call helper functions or HTML helpers. And so instead I could say HTML dot, and I could take advantage of methods that will generate things like checkboxes or text boxes. One of the other helper methods we have is called action link. What action link does is it allows you to specify some link text. So in this case, we'll pass in the category name as the link text. I can then specify what is the action method name I want to call. So we'll call this browse. And then what are the parameters I want to optionally send to this URL. And so in this case here, I'm going to say send a new parameter called category. And I'm going to pass in the category name as the value I want to send. Make sense? So now when I run that, I get, instead of just simple text, I now get hyperlinks, which have an ahref equals pointing to that URL, and then the text that's outputted as part of it. So now when I click the URLs, so let's go to produce, I get produce, seafood, I get seafood, beverages, I get beverages. So that's sort of an example of one controller, two action methods working both against the model, and I basically tie them together with this helper function, and away we go. Someone asked earlier, can you do product slash beverages instead of having a query string? So let's talk a little bit about routing rules. So the way ASP.NET MVC works is, again, when a URL comes in, we have a routing engine that determines what controller and what action method on a controller run in order to process that URL. The routing engine is flexible, and you saw in the first talk how I could map URL routes to different web form pages. I could do the same thing with MVC and map URLs to controller classes as well. And it gives me a lot of flexibility in terms of how things work. So the way to do this is I'm going to go in and open my global.sax file, which has my application start event in ASP.NET. And you'll notice inside here we have a couple of routing rules that have been configured. First one is an ignore rule, which basically says anything for a resource.axt. So for example, URLs that ASP.NET generates for scripts, just ignore and don't process. The second one is what we call our default map rule, which basically says by default, treat the first part of the URL as the controller name, the second part is the action method name, the third part as a parameter called ID. And it says if nothing is specified, make the default controller home, call the index method on it, and pass in the parameter. And that's how, you know, when the URLs come in and for simple controller and index got called by default, it's because the default action is called index. You can change it to be whatever you want, and it would replace that. If I want to register my own rule, let's create a new one for that product browse scenario. I could say routes.map route ahead of it. I could say products browse as the name of the rule. I could then say, let's create a format, which is to say when the URL is products slash browse, let's treat the third parameter not as ID but as the parameter called category. And when that happens, let's call a controller with, jet lag is kicking in, a controller called products. And then we'll basically say, let's call the action method browse. And if no category is specified, we'll just pass in an empty string to that category method. Make sense? And now when I run this and hit refresh here, one thing that's interesting is because our helper methods are going to, you know, if you remember in our HTML, we said action link, go to the browse action method. Instead of hard-coding in a particular URL, it hit the routing engine and said, what route rule handles the browse method? ASP.NET MVC will say, hey, there's this new routing rule that's been configured. Don't go to browse, question mark, category equals name. Guess what? You can actually go to browse slash beverages, and it will automatically output the correct URL. And now you'll notice I have friendly URLs for my product section, so I can do product slash browse condiments with no query string parameter. Make sense? So a pretty easy way to set up routing rules, map them to methods. You can change routing rules at a later point, and your controller and view code will automatically update and incorporate those new routing rules as part of the application. Any questions as part of that? So right now in our application, we have controllers that are directly instantiating the link to SQL data context and working directly against it. You can certainly do that for small applications, that's totally fine. As you build larger applications, though, what you'll typically find is if you're accessing your database directly within your controller, you're going to find that you duplicate queries in multiple places, and it's harder to swap out implementations at a later point. And so what I'm going to do here now is implement what's called a service layer, which basically provides a level of encapsulation between my data code and between my controller code. Service layer does not necessarily mean a web service, although you certainly could use it as a web service. Basically, just think of it as a class that we're going to take advantage of between our controllers and our actual data access code. So to implement this, I'm going to go to the models folder here, and I'm going to create a new class. And I'm going to call this class Northwind Service. You can either watch me type all this, or it's late and it's Friday. I'm just going to create a simple class here called Northwind Service. All this is doing is internally still creating Northwind data context, has an all categories method, an all products method, a find products and category helper method, a get product method, an add, delete, and save method. Fairly simple, thin wrapper on top of our link to SQL code. But it does mean if I wanted to, for example, use link to entities instead of link to SQL, I could change it in this one place. My controllers would never know the difference. So it does give me a lot of flexibility to use any different data technique or in one place encapsulate my queries for future use. I can then go back here now to my Northwind service, or my products controller. We'll switch from using the Northwind data context directly to using the Northwind service. And now I can just say Northwind. We have that all categories method. And I could replace this and say, instead of having that raw SQL or a raw link, I could say find products and category. Everything continues to work. My app still functions, but now I have a service layer between my controllers and my actual raw data access code. And you'll see a little bit later when we start introducing testing and things like that, this is going to make it a lot easier for me to unit test it. So we've implemented some simple product browse. Let's now implement some CRUD support. Then we're going to add validation and show a bunch of other stuff. So when I talk about CRUD, you know, think of it as create, read, update, and delete. It's sort of standard data operations. And ASP.NET MVC handles this pretty well. Rather than add these operations directly on my products class, let's create a new controller that I'm going to call admin controller. And you'll notice that there's a checkbox when you add a controller that you can optionally select, which allows you to add action methods that are predefined for all your standard CRUD operations. And so now I have edit methods, create methods, index and details methods directly within here. I could then quickly say, let's create a Northwind service using that service layer. Let's just say var products is equal to northwind.allproducts.toList. And I'm going to say let's display that list of products when you hit the slash admin URL. Let's create a view template for this. I'm going to base it on products. I'm going to say make it a list, hit add, and I said don't look at the scaffolding earlier. Now you can look at the scaffolding. Basically, you'll notice by default when you selected that template, it auto-generated HTML for you and helper functions based using reflection on what the type that you specified inside that dialog. I could get rid of a couple of these values. We'll get rid of the helper functions here. And now, when I say slash admin, I'll get a listing of all the products in my database. And you can see the CRUD form gave me default columns, default formatting for values, and edit and details link so I can drill into edit or details for any of the individual products. To implement, let's say, the details, I could go here and say var products is equal to northwind.getProduct. And I'm going to pass in the ID, which is a value that's going to get passed to the details URL. And then I can say, let's render a view based on the product. We can scaffold that. We're going to create a details view. Let's do that. And so I could say product details. And now if I click details on Chai, I'll get a nice little listing for the Chai or the Chang details. I can delete whatever columns I want within that. If I want to implement edit support, go down the edit link here. Bar product equals northwind.getProductID. Pass in product. Right click, and we'll add edit support. One thing I will mention is that we're hoping to get in for MVC2 is an auto scaffold which will actually generate your controller and all your views based on, say, a link to seek or a link to entities template you specify, so you don't have to do each one of these separate. Let's get rid of just a few of these. Just to keep life a little bit simpler. One of the things you'll notice here is there's some helper functions for text box and validation that are being added for me automatically. Now when I click edit, oops, I gotta recompile. But now when I click edit, I'll get a form view for that product object. To implement save support, I could go back to my admin controller. I have an edit view right now that's handling HTTP GET requests. I can also implement one that handles POST. You can either use this syntax, which worked in ASP.NET MVC1 and still works in MVC2, or you can also now just say HTTP POST to indicate this is an override that will be handled for POST submits. And all I'm going to do here is basically say get the product from the database. I can then attempt to update the object using the form posted values submitted from the client. And so we have a helper method called update model that does that. I could then say northwind.save in order to save any of the changes back to the database. And since Link to SQL supports change tracking, I've got the original value, applied the updates, telling Link to SQL to save it back. And then if there's an error, I'm just going to say redisplay the product one more time with us that has the last user's updated errors. Hit refresh now. I can change this to be Scott. Hit save. Went to the post version of that URL. We applied the changes, successfully applied it, redirected back to the link to the index, and you can see the changes were reflected. Make sense? So a very simple CRUD form that we've put in place here. You might say, gosh, there's a lot of things right now on this page. So scrolling here is a little bit of an issue. We could go back and change this and say, what if we have a page index that's nullable so that user can optionally indicate what page of the data that they want to see. So I could say admin question mark page equals 1, page equals 2, etc. I could then say int page size equals 10, int start index is equal to, and what I could say page dot get value or default, which will be 0 if it's not specified, times page size. So that will let me calculate what the start index of it should be. And because my service is returning back an iQueryable, I can actually say skip start index and take page size of content before generating that list. So this is taking advantage of kind of a nice property of Link to SQL and Link to Entities and Link, which is this iQueryable support, which allows deferred operation. So this means until I do the to list, I don't actually hit the database. And so now when I hit refresh, I'm only seeing 10 rows. If I say page equals 2 or 1, you can see I can basically skip throughout that data. I'm only ever actually hitting the database and returning 10 rows. I'm not actually returning back all the products as I'm doing it. So pretty easy way that you can add paging into your application and only display the 10 rows that you want. So a little bit clean there. As you saw, we have basic editing support in place. Any questions on that?
Yep.
Why is there no standard delete functionality?
Why is there no standard delete functionality? It's a good question. I think we want to prevent you from accidentally deleting your data. But you can certainly add, you can copy and paste one of those methods and make them delete. So you can do that. That's Actually, it's a good question. No one's ever asked that. probably should update the template. The good news is all these templates that were generating the views as well as the controllers are also T4 templates, and so you can override with your own customization if you want to. You certainly could. Well, you could. The way Link to SQL will work is it actually won't hold any connections open. It'll actually close the connection after each operation. So you don't absolutely need to. You could if you want to basically make sure you dispose of any objects at the end of the controller request. You certainly could. Let's talk a little bit about validation, and we'll show a couple of cool features that are coming in MVC 2. So one of the concepts that we often talk about with MVC from a programming model design perspective is this concept we call, or this phrase we call skinny controllers with fat models. It sounds kind of weird, but basically the concept here is as you're building your MVC application, you want to use your controllers to basically handle input, to handle kind of application UI style scenarios. You don't want to embed business logic inside your controllers. That's why we created that service layer, which is sort of a level between our controllers and our data layer. When it comes to validation, for example, let's say I want to make sure that a unit price is greater than zero, or let's say I make sure the product name is never null. I don't want to be writing code inside my controller or inside my views, for that matter, that embed that logic. Instead, that's a business rule. I want to put it in my model layer. The benefit of putting it in my model layer is it means that anywhere within the application that accesses the database, that validation rule will be enforced. It also means that I can change the validation rule in one place and have every UI element inside my app automatically get updated to take advantage of it. So I have both a create, an edit, and a delete scenario. If I add a validation rule in the model layer, all of those different actions will enforce that validation rule regardless of how that model access is actually done. In ASP.NET MVC, there's multiple ways that you can actually do model-level validation. You can roll your own. In ASP.NET MVC V1, we had support for what we call idea or info, which is the standard interface that WPF and Windows Forms also supports. In ASP.NET MVC 2, we're actually adding another built-in mechanism which uses the data annotation feature that Dynamic Data uses inside ASP.NET Web Forms, and which Silverlight also uses as part of the RIA services capability, and which provides a bunch of cool features, which we'll see in just a second. So let's add a validation layer to my app. To do this, I'm going to create a class called Product, which I'm going to add inside my Models folder. I'm going to mark this class as partial. And then basically, if you remember my Northwind Link to SQL class, I created a product class that mapped to the table. By marking this thing as partial, it basically means I can add any methods I want to that product object and basically inject my own code inside that product definition without having to worry about the tool stomping on top of my code later. What we can then do is since C# and VB don't yet support the notion of partial properties, there's a concept we call buddy classes that I can create. And so I can create a product validation class, like so, which I can use to encapsulate my validation rules, and then I'm going to link to my product class. And so to do this, I can say, for any method I want to add some data, so let's call it product name. I basically create a property. I can then add an attribute, like required. And there's a bunch of built-in attributes inside the system.componentModel.dataAnnotations namespace. And I could say there's an error message that will be displayed if this validation rule fails, which is name required. Someone asked me earlier, how would I localize this? The good news is there is actually an error message resource type as well, string that you can provide. So if you want to localize these error messages, you can do that too and store them in external resources. I'm then going to add a, let's say, price required. And so we'll add a unit price. Property here. And so I'm going to also make the price required in the product. And I'm going to go one step further, which is I'm going to add a range property. And I'm going to say basically the price needs to be at least a penny. And I'll say you can go up to, let's say, double dot max value. And I'm going to say price invalid or price needs to be higher. So I guess it can't go any higher than max. Oops. My eagerness to make money, I screwed that up. Still screwed it up. What did I do? Oh, yes, thank you.
But another question.
Sure.
The price is a double, so it's always there because it's a fully type, isn't it?
But it could be zero.
Required means it must be more or less than zero.
Correct. And so what I'm doing with this range validator is saying it can't be zero.
That's the range validator, but I'm talking about the required validator.
Ah, okay, yeah. So the question is the required validator. Basically, that's correct. And in the final version of Basement MVC, we'll actually do implicit validation for value types. We actually just pulled that feature out of Preview 2 because we had one bug on it. The reason I added it here was so I could customize the error message, though. And so this basically allows me to customize exactly what that error message is. So let's see what actually this looks like. So I basically added this validation class. Last step I'm going to do is just link it to my product profit class. So I'm just going to say there's metadata type product validation on top of my rules here. And now when I go ahead and edit this, you'll notice if I change that and I change this to be nothing, hit enter, nothing happened. Did you spell that right? We'll rerun that. There we go. The recompile is the trick. So basically, you'll notice now I'm getting server-side validation rules automatically enforced. You might be wondering how in the world did it know to do that. Basically, anytime you use the data annotations, or iData or info for that matter, when you use the update model method on the controller class, which we're using right here, basically if there are any validation errors, we'll automatically populate the errors collection and then raise an exception, which is causing that template to be re-rendered. And then within our index.asbx page, edit.asbx page, you'll notice that we have a validation summary helper method, which is displaying that message right there. So if I wanted to customize that, I absolutely could. It's then going to display bulleted lists of those items. And then you'll notice next to each of our properties here, I have a validation message. And if there's any errors for that product name or supplier ID or any of these values, it'll then go ahead and display a little star and highlight the text box and then render it there. All this is CSS customizable, basically just by adding those attributes on your classes, you now get built-in server validation by default. Yep.
Is it also possible to dynamically display the actual error message for each field?
Yes, so instead of actually doing the star, just actually display it to the right, you mean?
What I mean is to display the name required or price required message at that place.
Yes, good question. So in other words, let's do this. Let's, instead of getting rid of the star, let's just say product name and do it like that. And then we could get rid of validation summary if we wanted to. I'll just keep that there. So you'll notice if I refresh here, it now displays it next to those as well. Now, let's do something really fancy that's never been seen in public before. So this is doing server-side validation. What if we also want to enable it on the client side as well, so that instead of having to post back to the server, we could get both server and client-side validation as well. So, like a magician here. Never been before done in public. New helper method that's going to be introduced as part of MVC Preview 2. HTML enable client validation. We got one important point, which is if you're going to use a JavaScript library, you also need to add references to the JavaScript library. So I'm going to add under this page, or I could add to the master page, jQuery, a new jQuery validation plugin that we're shipping, as well as a helper library that we support. Hit refresh now, and it works. Delete that, hit enter. And without posting back to the server, you now have automatic client-side validation, also being picked up from your model validation rules. Enter Scott, tab away, notice the error message disappears. Add zero, notice the price needs to be higher. Point one, tabs away, enter, away you go. So basically with that one line, you can now get both client and server-side validation. You're applying at your model layer, which means that any place on your site that you're doing edits or updates will automatically pick up the new change at any point that you change your model layer, and the changes will percolate everywhere within your app. Questions? Yeah?
If your model changes, is there any way to rebuild your views?
Good question. So if the model changes, is there any way to rebuild your views? You can certainly build views that are dynamic. And in fact, I'll show that just a little bit, how to do that. Good question. Yeah. So yes, there is. And we'll talk about that in a second. Just remember. Yeah.
Customizable is the generated JavaScript? I mean, can you leverage the validation, client-side validation for at other moments, or customize it so for example where they just type and validate it immediately?
Yeah, so you get a couple of things. So a couple of nice things that we've done with Preview 2 that you'll start to see. And there still are some rough areas of the client-side validation, so we haven't finished exposing all the hooks. But a couple of things that are nice is, one is the actual validation approach you use is independent of the client-side validation. So if you're using Castle Validator, if you're using Entity Block Validator that ships as part of the PAG, a Prescriptive Architecture Guidance block, if you want to create your own validation system that uses your own custom rules engine, you can plug that into MVC and still take advantage of our helpers and still take advantage of the client-side validation. So that's completely pluggable what the rules engine is. Likewise, the client-side validation is also completely pluggable. So you can use our view, our engine, our server-side, and then build your own client-side helpers that actually do the client-side validation for you automatically. So that's also pluggable as well. Right now, you know, basically, we spit out, and you know, we use jQuery validation, and then, let's go to the edit page. So we basically use jQuery validation for the UI enablement. And then basically we have a JSON-based format for indicating, you know, the field, the type of validation, where the error message goes. And again, that's pluggable, and you can put anything you want inside there. So you could replace that, or you could write your own script that handles it. So it's very pluggable, but at the same time we're trying to make sure out of the box you get a good experience as well.
This is
good for what I'd say basically input validation. So if you have like business logic rules, you're typically not going to expose them directly as attributes. You certainly can add attributes at your class layer, and we'll actually honor those. In a lot of those scenarios, it's going to be hard to provide automatic client-side UI validation, but there's basically the hopes to add your own logic for those things as well. So, a little bit on validation. A couple other things that people often ask for with ASP.NET MVC 1, kind of two features. One is the ability to get strongly typed UI helpers. So instead of saying HTML.textbox, quote, product name, is there some ways that you can get IntelliSense and compile time checking of your UI helpers as well? It's a common request people ask. And then also people have often asked for, how do I customize or templatize the UI that's generated from those UI helpers? Is there an easy way to override the HTML output that gets generated? Going back to someone's question, is there a way to get dynamic UI generated? Is another question people sometimes have asked for. So what we've done with MVC 2 is introduced a new helper that we call the Editor 4 helper. And we'll see how this works in just a second. So right now you'll notice I have HTML.textbox product name, and then I enter the product name value. I can now in MVC 2 say HTML Editor 4. And you can then say model model dot product name. So it's strongly typed, you're getting IntelliSense. And I don't have to specify the value twice. Instead, I can actually use this lambda expression to both look up the name as well as the actual associated value. And so hit save, hit refresh, and it works exactly the same. Now the editor 4, you notice I'm not hard coding in the text box. We'll see this in a second. I can change what type of data it is pretty easily. In fact, let's just see this in action. We'll get rid of all those field sets. I'm just going to replace them with editor 4 versions. And so you'll notice here I have a product name, a category name, unit price, units in stock, discontinued. Going back to someone's question here, which is, what happens if your model type changes? Notice the editor 4 is not type specific. It actually works with any data type. And I can actually override what it looks like on a per data type basis. And now you can see I have product name, category. Discontinued is a Boolean property, and so by default, our template is a checkbox for Boolean values. Make sense? As I mentioned, the other thing people have often asked for, in addition to strongly typedness, is the ability to customize what the UI is generating. And so what we've done is made both the editor 4, and then there's also an equivalent display 4 property, overridable. So you can now create reusable templates and customize like what a decimal looks like when it's edited, what a checkbox looks like when it's edited, what a product object looks like when it's edited. So you can override it any layer there, stick it in one place, and have it apply across the site. So again, this is new in ASP.NET MVC 2. So let's start with something simple here. Notice my unit price right now with the default editor 4 template is 0.0100. Let's say I want to actually change that. So instead of having 4 digits, I just want to actually display 2 digits. I could change it within this template directly, or what I could do is I could create a separate view template or an editor template that I could reuse across all my views and all my controllers. And that's what we'll do right now because it's a little bit what we call dry or don't repeat yourself reusable. So to do this, I'm going to basically create a new folder called editor templates. And you can store it underneath the views folder of your controller. So in this case here, I want this editor template to apply to all my admin views. And then I can basically say add new view, create as what's called a partial class, and I'm just going to call this thing decimal. And so what I'm effectively saying is I want to override how decimals are edited anytime the admin actually edits a decimal. If you're familiar with ASP.NET WebForms Dynamic Data, this is sort of a similar concept of overriding. And so what I could do is here is you'll notice I'm just saying use the text box helper, register it, and then just restrict 2 decimals to be displayed. Hit refresh, and notice now the unit price is now 0.10. So I've basically overridden how many decimals are displayed. Make sense? Another interesting scenario here, let's say I want to have it replace this category ID with a drop-down list of categories, so I'm doing a foreign key representation of it. I could say, let's create a new template, and we'll call it category list box, or drop list, drop down, I don't know, we can call it whatever we want. Create a new template here. I'm going to use the drop down list control, and basically what I'm going to do is just inside here, I'm going to pull from the view data a categories object, and create a list. And what this means now is I don't have to change my view at all. Take it back. I do. Go to my edit. Change this to be category. I'm still going to pass in the category ID as a parameter here, but I'm going to specify now, let's use the category drop down, or what do I call that? Drop down. Template. We'll come back to these things. You can do it declaratively in a different way in a little bit. And I'm just going to go back to my admin controller here, and I'm going to say for both my edit scenario and then my error scenario, I'm going to update the view data, pass in the categories listing, which is Northwind dot all categories dot to list. If I wanted to, I can make a strongly typed view model that had both the listing as well as the product. So I don't have to use the view data, but for instance, time, we'll just use this. hit refresh, and now I have a drop-down list for my foreign keys, and I can very easily this is a good opportunity to talk about, I accidentally whacked the save button when we replaced the field stuff. This is a great opportunity to talk about how form submits work. So what I can do here is I can say input type equals submit, value equals save. Rather than do a postback model, what MVC does is it basically uses kind of raw HTML, HTTP posts for doing values. And so I'm displaying an HTML form here, and I have a submit button, which when I press it, will do a post back to wherever that form is pointing to and submit its values. So it's not, you know, I don't have a button click event handler. Instead, I just simply say post this form. It goes to that URL, which is an action method, and then it redisplays. So, it just works the way HTML and HTTP work as standard. So you can see now I have that drop-down list. Now I hard-coded that the template name inside my view template. So someone else was asking, how easily can I just change my model? Do I have to regenerate my templates? One thing that's kind of cool is if I wanted to, I could actually get rid of this category listing here, or the actual explicit name here. So by default, it's going to go back to a text box. But what I could do is I could actually, on my ViewModel class, so for example, my product class here, in addition to validation rules, I can optionally add what are called like UI hints. So if I wanted to, I could say public in category ID, and I could say UI hint category dropdown. Basically says, hey, if there's a category dropdown template, use it to render. And now if I make that change anywhere on the site that it's in editing format, by default, the category ID will basically pick that up. You can likewise use it entirely on an object. So I could actually, I've never actually done this, so we'll see if it works. At least I've never done it in a demo. But in theory, which is sometimes different than practice, I could actually replace all of those individual fields with a HTML.editor for the actual model itself. So in other words, I'm passing in the entire product. And in theory, it worked. It basically, you can see, I need to work on the CSS, but it basically automatically generated an edit view based on all the public properties on that type. Even cooler, it noticed it picked up the right decimal override as well as the right category idea override on top of the product. And so now I can actually add, remove, rename any of these properties it would show or hide based on this without me ever having to change my view template. So I answered that question, the dynamic thing. And if I wanted to hide something, again, we're straying into things I've never actually done, but I asked the team to implement. So we'll see if it did. In theory, there should be scaffold column false. And so for unit price, bloop, disappeared. They get to keep their jobs. Anyway, so in general, I'd say if you're directly working off your database models, you might not want to stick some of this UI-specific stuff in there because you are starting to mix your UI as well as your data model concerns. However, if you're creating view model classes like we did earlier with the Say Hello view model, which are very kind of classes optimized for UI display, then putting these attributes for UI hints and scaffolding hints and things like that make more sense and are appropriate from a architecture perspective. Any questions on that? Yeah. Yep. Yes, the question is, for the editor template, can you actually specify a generic model, or does it have to be laid down? Yeah, you can absolutely create a generic-based model as well, so you can get full IntelliSense within that as well. So the question is, are there helper methods for strong type action links? So I showed the strongly typed lambda syntax for editor 4. Is there URLs for routing links as well? Not right now in preview 2. It's something we're looking to hopefully get into V2. There's a couple of approaches that we're still playing with to ways to do it. One is lambda syntaxes. One is T4 code generation. It's not in preview 2. We're trying to focus on the validation and the client-side stuff in V2, in preview 2. But it might still make it into the final version 2 release. Okay, cool. We should chat afterwards then. So anyway, I showed some templated UI helpers. Last thing we do before testing is introduce this concept called action filters. These are basically ways that you can build kind of what we sometimes call cross-cutting concern logic. So in other words, logic you want to apply to multiple controllers or multiple action methods within your app. And you want to be able to encapsulate in one place as an attribute that you can then declaratively apply. So for example, in my admin controller here, let's say I want to enforce authorization. So in other words, I don't want anonymous users to be able to change the price on my site. Seems reasonable. You can add an authorize attribute, either to the controller or an individual action method level. And now when we try to access this page, since I'm not logged in, it's going to automatically send me to a login page and enforce authentication. I can register a new user, say hello user. Just happen to have my email address. It's creating my database for the very first time. I'm now logged in as the say hello user. And now when I go to the admin URL, I have access to admin things. Now often you don't want to just allow any login user. You want to actually restrict it to a role. And so one of the things I could do is I could actually say you must be in the admin security role in order to have access to that page. This uses the standard role-based security mechanism that's in supported in ASP.NET today. And so I could go to... Oh, yeah, that thing. I go to security tab. I could basically enable role-based security for my app. I could create the new admin role. I could then basically say, let's have the say hello, filter by say hello. By S. I could basically add them into that role. And now if I go to the admin page, I have access to it. If someone dislikes me, kicks me out, I automatically deny. So easy way to apply role-based security to both the controller level, and you can change override it on a per-action basis as well in your app. We have other filters for doing error handling. And all these things, you can create your own filters and plug them in. So if you have any type of cross-cutting concern logic within your app, you can easily encapsulate it and stick it as a filter. Yep.
Do we have control over the instantiation?
Good question. So the question is, do you have control over instantiation controllers? The answer is yes. Ask me that again in a few minutes. So I'm going to introduce dependency injection, which is a perfect point to talk about that. So let's talk about unit testing. So I'm doing unit testing last. Generally, we don't necessarily recommend you always do your unit testing last, but I wanted to kind of introduce the basics of MVC before I actually introduced unit testing into that. So people often think of unit testing as a way to find bugs. I actually don't typically think of it as a way to find bugs, although sometimes you do find bugs out of it. I think of unit testing as a way to kind of enable you to code with confidence. Meaning you can write unit tests that cover the functionality you already have implemented. And because unit tests are hopefully small, really fast to run, you can later change your code, rerun your unit tests, and find out if you've broken anything. And that confidence to change your code and know that if you've done something dumb, you're going to catch it in the unit test means that you can actually restructure your app, you can actually re-architect your app, you can introduce features into the app at a much more faster rate because you don't have to worry about manually testing 25 different scenarios every time you add some lines of code. You no longer have to worry about, geez, do I really want to roll this out into production? Hope I didn't introduce a bug. You have a little bit more confidence. And that gives you some more power as a developer to write code faster in the long run. So let's introduce unit testing real quick, and then we'll introduce dependency injection and a few other more exciting stuff. So we're going to create a simple unit test for our models. We'll call this the product tests. One of the things you'll notice with VS10 is we don't stick all this junk when you first create a unit test anymore, which is quite nice. So I just delete that. It's not really called junk, it's actually added value. But we no longer force our added value on So I'm going to write a simple test. Basically, the way you write tests, if you haven't written unit tests before, so you had a class inside a test project, you marked it with a test class attribute. You then add any number of public methods that have a test method attribute on them, and then you can name these methods anything you want. A general style that we often use is make them long, verbose, and descriptive, and that way, whenever a test fails, you have a decent chance of looking at the actual test method name to figure out what the actual test did and what it actually broke. So here I'm just going to say verify product name can be set. This is a really simple, dumb test. But you can use any number, any type of style to write unit tests. One that a lot of people use is something called a range act assert. The idea behind a range is, this is a great example. That's not a good example. A range is sort of set up the thing that you're going to test, so the unit test. So in this case here, I'm going to test the product object. I'm going to act in order to do something. And so here I'm going to set product name equal to Scott. And then I'm going to assert, and I'm basically just going to say assert r equal my expected value, which is Scott, and my actual value, which is product dot product name. And if there's an error, I'm just going to say value did not match or something. Yeah, fairly simple test. I can then right click and say run tests. It'll run the tests in the context of that cursor, and you'll see right now it passed. So again, very simple test, but it kind of illustrates the concept of test class, test method, a range act assert. Let's now go ahead and write. The nice thing about MVC is because it kind of teased apart our model layer from our controller layer from our view layer, we can now write these unit tests at any of those micro layers and actually verify functionality. And so specifically, I can test my controller without having to have any HTML rendering. And you'll see in a little bit, I can test my controllers without actually having to hit a database. And that ability to tease apart the application means that you can test at a fine-grained level, which makes your test really fast. The downside with having slow tests is you're much less likely to run them. If they're super fast, you can just hit a keystroke and in 2 seconds they pass. You're much more likely to run them, and as a result, be able to code a lot faster. So we're going to create another test class here in the controllers folder. We're going to call this products controller. Product controller test. We're going to remove the added value. Test method. And I'm going to basically test my controller. So I'm going to say, let's test the admin controller. So we'll test the admin controller, and let's say the index method. We'll say index action rendered view. So in other words, I want to make sure the index action didn't do a redirect, and instead it rendered a view template. So I'm going to say arrange var controller is equal to new admin controller. I'm going to act, which is I'm going to say call the controller.index method, and I'll pass an index of 0. And I'm going to say I'm going to expect it to return back a view result, which indicates that the controller method returned to view by calling that view helper method. And then I'm going to assert that is not null, that the result was not null. And the way C sharp will use it is if it returned anything but a view result, result will end up being null. That's what the as keyword does. And I could basically say expected view. Compiled it, clean, run, fail. That's by design. We'll talk about it in a second. So why did this thing fail? Well, if you read the error message, it's basically saying, hey, it couldn't connect to the database. And that kind of makes sense, because if you... if you actually look at this code that we have, you'll know that when we create the admin controller, we actually call the index method. We use the Northwind object, which right now is actually instantiating my Northwind service, which is going directly against the database. This is an example of tight coupling of my data access logic with my controller. We have a nice service interface, so that's nice, because that way we have a level of indirection. But my controller is effectively calling an object which is directly talking to the database, which means I always have to have a database to test. And right now, because I have a test project, it doesn't actually have the web.config file, so that's why it failed. It wasn't able to connect to the database directly. Now, I could fix this by adding in my app.config a connection string to my SQL database, in which case my test will run. A couple downsides with doing that, though, are when I do that, it's going to require that my database always be reset. And so I'm going to have to write a bunch of setup and teardown logic in order to reset it. And the other big benefit, the downside, is it means that the tests are going to run fairly slow because hitting data access is going to be slow. And if I have, say, 100 of these little methods testing my admin controller, doing 100 teardown reset up of my database might take 60 seconds or 90 seconds. Now, 60 or 90 seconds is still dramatically better than having to manually test 100 different scenarios. But there's another approach we can use which enables a little bit better testing called dependency injection. And in the movies, there's a phrase in Hollywood, don't call us, we'll call you, which is a way of basically rejecting someone. But it's kind of appropriate for dependency injection. What it basically says is, controller, don't call the Northwind service. Instead, we're going to give you a Northwind service instance to use when we first create you. And so we're going to take all of your dependencies and pass them as constructor arguments to the controller, and you're going to work off of the parameters we pass you, not create them yourself. The benefit there is we can then create fake services that don't require the database that the controller can end up using in testing scenarios to make our tests much faster and less dependent on a database schema. So let's actually do that. We're going to do a couple things to do this. We're going to go into our Northwind service class, that facade class we put in front of our database. We're going to go ahead and encapsulate this. So instead of actually being just a class, we're going to have it also implement an interface. So we're going to extract a iNorthwind service interface out of this. We're going to expose all those methods on it, hit OK. And now we have a public interface called iNorthwind service. Step two, and so you can see here, we simply implement the iNorthwind service interface, compile, everything's working great. We're then going to go into our admin controller, and instead of having a field reference of Northwind called Northwind service, change it to be iNorthwind service. Now, because Northwind service implements that, you hit compile, everything's good. We're then going to do two things. First is we're going to add some constructors. I'm going to so instead of actually declaring this directly, I'm instead just going to have a field called iNorthwindService. I'm then going to write a constructor. Oops. I'm going to write a constructor called AdminController, which takes an iNorthwindService as a parameter. And I can say Northwind equals service. And now, instead of the admin controller creating its Northwind service, instead, when an admin controller gets created, we're going to pass in an iNorthwind service as a constructor argument to that controller. Now, optionally, the other thing I'm going to do is implement what's called poor man's dependency injection. And I'm going to say, if you can create this controller with no parameters, I'm going to still create the Northwind service directly. We'll talk about this in a later point when we talk about Unity, which is a question that came up earlier. But this is basically a way that you can implement dependency injection without having to wire up anything extra. Again, we'll come back to this, but it's a good next step we can do on our path to unit testing enlightenment. So anyway, we have an admin controller. We have a dependency thing that's being passed in. What this means now is I can still run my controller. You know, everything's going to continue to work. But now I have an option when I create the admin controller. I can pass in an iNorthwind service instance that I want my controller to use only in the context of this unit test. Make sense? Now, to do that, rather than hit the database directly, we're going to create one more folder here called fakes. I'm then going to create a class, which is called the fake Northwind service. I can say I want to implement the LDAP style provider. That is. So I basically implement the iNorthwind service, and I could say implement all the methods on it. So I could go ahead and implement my own version of the iNorthwind service that doesn't go against the database, but instead just uses like an in-memory list of product objects and category objects. Just in the interest of time, I'll just copy and paste one I have in here. And so what this fake Northwind service I just copied it does, it implements iNorthwind service. It maintains an in-memory list collection of products, and you basically pass in all the products as a constructor parameter to this, and then it just implements all the same methods, but basically off of that in-memory list. Makes sense? There's no database dependency whatsoever. And lastly, then what I can, so you do this once for your project, and then lastly what I can do is I'm going to create a, I'm going to create a helper method. I put either as a static, or I'm just going to implement it on my controller test here, called create Northwind service fake. And all this does is, when I call it, it's going to create a sequence of fake in-memory objects and return back a fake iNorthwind service, which means that I can go here and just say create Northwind service fake. File, hit run, now my test passes. I don't have to hit a database. I don't actually have to change anything anytime my schema changes. Instead, if I want to add new scenarios, I can just add dummy data into that helper method, write any number of unit tests I want for my product or for my admin controller. I could write 150 tests that test all the different combinations. What if I pass in -1 for the page index? What if I pass in null? What if user enters this bogus data or that bogus data? I could run all those 150 tests probably in about a second and a half, if yes. And so now anytime I make a change, I can hit a hotkey, basically run all my unit tests and know within a second or two, did I make a breaking change as part of that? And so going back to that coding with confidence, you can now make changes anywhere within your application and get immediate feedback as to whether you broke something. And not only is that going to help you prevent getting bugs, but it also means you feel much more comfortable now changing your code, changing how it's architected. You don't always have to have this nagging fear. When I'm done with the day and I go through all my tests manually in the browser, am I going to discover I just horrendously broke the functionality of the app 10 hours after I broke it? And, of course, if your unit test fails, because you're running it constantly, you hopefully have only done a few steps since you last ran the tests, and so you'll know immediately what part of the code actually broke as far as when you're doing that. A couple things in terms of unit testing and TDD. In that first part of my talk, remember when I created ADO.NET, the ADO.NET entity framework, and I added that code item? What's nice is it created fakes for me automatically. It created an interface for me automatically. And so all the steps I just did here, where I created the iNorthwind service interface, where I created that create fake helper method, and I created all that stuff, basically all that gets done can get done for you as part of the T4 template. So literally as easy as dragging and dropping those tables on the designer, every time you make a change, all your test helpers will get automatically updated. And so literally the only things I need to write for this entire thing would be those three lines of code. to test that method. You also saw in the VS 2010 talk how I used TDD so that I could actually write my test first and then actually create the controller based on the usage of the test and have IntelliSense and VS actually help with creating that class. That also is kind of like the next step in terms of unit testing, where you start to write your tests first, you write your code in very small chunks, write the test, then implement the code, write the next set of tests, write the next set of code, and you kind of iteratively kind of design. You know, it doesn't work. You know, some people don't like it, but you know, a lot of people swear by it, and it you know, is now fully supported with VS 2010. I mentioned lastly then sort of poor man's dependency injection. So you'll notice here, I still have inside my admin controller class a scenario where I'm directly creating the Northwind service. I did this mainly for ease of use. There's an option where you can actually delete this entirely, and then there's an extensibility point in ASP.NET so that anytime we can create a controller, we actually call you and you actually give us back an instance. And so you can take advantage of a feature called an inversion of control container or a dependency injection container. Inversion of control container sounds weird, but it's slightly naughty. But basically, the idea there is instead of newing up the object directly, you ask a container to give it to you, and the container can wire up all the dependencies and automatically inject the appropriate service for you. And what the containers let you do is you could actually have a separate container configuration for deployment versus testing versus debugging. And so you could have your deployment and your you know, in-browser testing using a database, and you could have your unit testing serving up fakes. And so that would allow you to get rid of that constructor argument. If you don't want to wire up a container, you can just, again, use this sort of poor man's dependency injection approach, which still allows you to get good unit testing as well. Makes sense? So, you know, some people say, do I have to use the unit testing? You know, there are benefits to it. You know, there is something new to learn. So if unit testing stuff feels a little bit overwhelming, you know, you don't have to do the unit testing. Still take advantage of MVC. A lot of people still like MVC for the kind of rawness it gives you to HTTP and HTML, URLs, posting, etc. Again, a lot of people from an enterprise perspective like it from a patterns perspective and the TDD testing perspective. And a lot of people don't like it at all and say, I just want to use web forms. Great. So all three of those are completely valid responses. And if you like all of them, like I do, because I love all my children, even better yet. So summary is why, again, as I mentioned, some people like MVC is kind of the rawness it gives you and the access it gives you in HTML and HTTP. A lot of people like the testability and TDD support. A lot of people like the ability to write more client-side JavaScript and really take advantage of AJAX. It works with both VS 2008 and .NET 3.5 today, so everything I showed here will ship and work on top of 2008 and 3.5. It will be a built-in option with VS 2010. All of the new TDD tooling support works great with this and really takes advantage of it. It is an open source project, so we do release ASP.NET MVC under an open source license. You can download the source. You're also free to modify it, reship it however you want. It does ship under a OSI open source license. You'll continue to see us add features to it. I showed today some of the new 2.0 features, specifically around validation and template helpers. I didn't get a chance to show areas. That basically is a way you can segment your app into multiple projects or multiple pieces, so you don't have to have all your controllers in one place. You can instead have your admin controllers over here and your accounts controllers over there. And have your views live closer to controllers for your sub-areas. Lots more features we're looking to add in terms of helper functioning around paging, caching, and others as part of the ASP.NET MVC 2 release. And keep an eye out on my blog. Very likely that Preview 2 will be Preview 2 of ASP.NET MVC 2 will be shipping hopefully in the next couple days. So everything I showed here, you'll be able to do on your own machine hopefully in the not-too-distant future. So with that, open up to questions. Cool. If you do have questions, send me mail. I want to thank everyone again for taking all the time on Friday. And I know it's really late to stick around and listen to this. I hope I got some value out of it. If you have any other questions, feel free to send me an email at scottview@microsoft.com. I am on Twitter, which I noticed that in the break some of you are too, twitter.com/scottview, and then visit my website, my blog at weblogs.asp.net/scottview to learn more. So thanks again, and have a great weekend.